Our next guest is Stuart Davis. He's been called the Twisted Mystic and a Punk Monk. He's a songwriter, musician, recording artist, a filmmaker who focuses on spiritual subjects and paranormal topics, including UFOs, alien abduction, ghosts, alternate realms of existence. He's released more than a dozen albums. He's also a Zen Buddhist, a meditation expert, created his own TV show. And on New Year's Eve, 2010, he had an encounter with a non-human entity, which he chronicles in an audio documentary called Man Meets Mantis. Let's sample a little piece of that.
At midnight on New Year's Eve, 2010, I had the strangest experience of my life. I was visited by an 8-foot-tall praying mantis entity. The encounter changed me as an artist and a spiritual seeker. And years later, I'm still trying to understand that event and all that followed, which included my family seeing a UFO, crazy synchronicities, auditory anomalies, and disturbing dreams. My name is Stuart Davis. I've been an artist full-time for 27 years. I work in music, TV, and film. Examining my experience with the mantis entity led me to discover that many artists have reported encounters with non-human entities. Contact with these enigmatic others radically impacts their artwork and lives. I wanted to meet other artists who've had these experiences and hear their stories in their words. And since I'm asking artists to share intimate details about these bizarre, transformative, and sometimes traumatic experiences, it only seems fair that I start by sharing mine.
And that will be the topic for the rest of this evening's program. Over the next 2 hours, we're going to have Stuart Davis walk us through this story of Man Meets Mantis, and it's a heck of a ride. I listened to it today, and it's a lot of fun, and I got a feeling that some of our listeners may have had similar encounters of their own. We'll be right back and meet Stuart Davis. Man Meets Mantis is the title of the audio documentary. We just heard a clip from it. We posted a link on Coast to Coast so you can hear the whole thing. And the creator of that audio documentary is my guest this evening, Stuart Davis. Welcome to the program.
How are you, George? It's good to hear your voice.
I greatly enjoyed it. It's a heck of a ride. I wonder, you know, not everyone would be willing to come forward and tell that kind of a story. You must have thought about it.
Oh, I've been thinking about it for years. I definitely spent the bulk of the last 2 or 3 years. My entire life has been eclipsed by this event that actually, as you mentioned, took place in 2010, but it really ramped up and the intensity of it builds as the years go on. And that's one of the things that's depicted in that documentary. But yeah, I mean, the short answer is I've not wanted to speak publicly about this at all because I've been spending so much time and attention trying to discern what the nature of these experiences actually is and to what extent I can glean the meaning behind them. It's been a very, very tricky ride. So this is the first time I'm going to have this conversation publicly, and I'm glad that it could be with you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. You trace in the documentary sort of the roots of this to your childhood when you had some medical experiences that you think probably contributed to it.
Yeah, it's a very strange intersection, but that's exactly correct. When I was a kid, for probably almost a decade of my life, I had chronic ear infections, which resulted in me having to go in for repeated surgeries. I had tubes in my ears over and over again. But chiefly, the way it manifested was in high fevers. And I would have high fevers, you know, anywhere between 3 and 6 or 7 times a year, around 104, 105. And in those fever states, I became strangely fond almost of these fever states. And I came to know them as almost another realm. And inside of those realms as a kid, I very vividly remember trying to get myself to remember what it was that I was experiencing inside of the fever states. And then the fever would break and I was not able to recollect what was so special about them for me after they would break. But I did remember vividly that fevers were special to me. And so later on in life, when I started to meditation practice and when I became a Buddhist practitioner, I immediately had this impulse that I wanted to try meditation in a high fever state. And oddly, right as I began the meditation practice, I stopped getting high fevers, and I didn't get sick for about almost another decade. And so a lot of time passed before my first opportunity came around, which was in 2010 on New Year's Eve. And that's where that audio doc sort of picks up at the beginning of the precipitating event. And that New Year's Eve in 2010, I did get this high fever, very high fever, and I realized and remembered it was my opportunity. So I did. I began meditating around 11:30 at night, and as the midnight hour approached and got closer, I had this spontaneous impulse to ask the fever a question. You know, in a lot of shamanic traditions or other esoteric spiritual traditions, fevers can be a communication device. They can be a kind of altered state that can sometimes carry special information. So I just spontaneously, I asked the fever, I want to meet my spiritual guides. And that is, you know, in that moment, I think I was expecting or maybe hoping for some discarnate Buddhist monks or something from in my tradition. And instead, what happened was this 8-foot tall praying mantis entity. It was definitely mantis. It didn't have antenna, so it was not exactly insectoid, but it was clearly manted. In a purple robe with a high collar, it just appeared directly in front of my bed and immediately shot some kind of current, some signal. It felt like being hit with a current of electricity or maybe like being electrocuted, but it was not painful. There was nothing uncomfortable about it. It just was sort of like I became a conductor for this signal, and it transmitted some strange combination of pops and clicks and a lot of powerful emotional current, but there was nothing verbal. So it was this strange experience of like having a very strong transmission of some kind, but it was not accompanied by any linguistic content. And the whole thing lasted for less than a minute, I would guess. And then it vanished. And the last component of the experience was that there was one English phrase left reverberating in my head, and that was, remember who you work for. So the whole thing lasted less than a minute, and I honestly, I had this strange hyper-lucid feeling. I was like intoxicated on clarity or something when it was done. I still had the fever, but it was an indelible, vivid, electrifying experience. And my wife was gone. I was alone in the house at that time. And when she came home, I told her about it with a lot of animation and excitement. But both of us just felt like that is very strange, didn't know what to make of it. And, you know, that kind of brings to a conclusion that first precipitating event. And I'll pause there in case.
Well, in the audio documentary, we suddenly hear your wife. We figure it out. It's a female voice. It's your wife giving her side of it. And the next day, I guess, is when you tell her the story, or it was right as soon as you got home?
It might have been the morning when I woke up, because, you know, one of the things that goes on with this, and the reason it was so important for me to have my wife and about a dozen other people that are in this documentary, is I had to, it's like I almost made this documentary to help me see that I'm not as crazy as I feel about everything that has happened to me, because luckily, I suppose, from my perspective, other people have experienced almost every component of this with me, with the exception of that initial event. So yeah, for sure, by the next morning, I had told my wife about it. And, you know, from her view, from that day forward, I have sort of conducted myself in a different way. I've been consumed with this mystery. But chiefly, there was a pause after that. It was years before the next chapter in the story happened, which was I was in Amsterdam. We had moved to Amsterdam to live there for a couple of years. And when I was there, I met an artist named Jasmine Karamova. And the first time that I met her, she was 16 years old, singer-songwriter. And I ended up signing her to my record label and releasing her record. But what was going on subtextually while that was going on is that as soon as I saw her, I just saw this entire movie in my head, and it was her in it, and the whole story was predicated on this character finding this mantis insect and having that redirect her whole life, and then she ends up in this very strong paranormal relationship with the larger version of the mantis entities, the non-human intelligence entities, is sort of how that story culminates. And I thought that was so strange, and I knew emotionally, I knew somehow somatically that the film I was seeing when I was looking at her was tied to the initial event that happened on New Year's. But I thought it was so strange, and I had just met this artist, that I didn't want to freak her out and say, hey, I'm seeing this whole movie in my head. So I didn't bring it up. I just went and wrote an outline of the film and set that aside, and basically waited years to even bring it up to her that I had put together this outline. Because the other thing that was going on in my head is that this film is so strange, no one's going to want to buy it. It's really just kind of my own unique thing.
Yeah, the line that you use in the documentary is, there's no way someone will make a paranormal sex trafficking movie in Russian.
Exactly right. And the funny thing is, her first language is Russian. And so the whole film felt formed and fully complete and tied to that initial experience. And so I just said, I'm going to write an outline of this, and I'm going to set it aside, because clearly that is just an aberrant anomaly of some kind. And then you fast forward to when we return to the United States. We come back after a couple of years in Amsterdam. I have signed that artist to my label. I have written the outline of that film, but not the script. And I'm at home in Colorado, and I'm down at the dog park in front of my house with my dog. And I'm lying on my back just waiting for my dog to do its business. And I see there's nothing visible in the sky. There are no stars out yet. There's nothing. And I see an orb that is about the size of my fingernail, if my arm is held out at arm's length. And this orb is moving horizontally across the sky. It crosses a large portion. You know, if you think of viewing the sky in front of you, it's kind of 180-degree spectrum. I would say this thing crossed maybe 30 degrees of that spectrum, and then it stopped, and then it moved straight up at a right angle. And when that happened, I had the same kind of emotional experience that I had with the initial visitation. I was just completely electrified and shocked. It's the most shocking thing I've ever seen in waking awareness. I just knew that whatever it was, it had moved at a right angle and stopped. And then it continued to do this for probably 10 minutes. It was doing a grid of some kind of right angles. And very simple demonstration that, you know, I'm not saying that there's no explicable accounting for it, that it could be man-made. I didn't know what it was. I just knew that, you know, airplanes don't move at right angles. They don't stop in the sky. Satellites don't move at right angles and stop in the sky. But I was also so worried that if I wanted to go get someone, because I was just me and my dog, but I was worried if I got up, it was going to vanish. And finally, I couldn't take it anymore. And so I ran home and I got my daughter, and we went up on the roof. And this is all recorded and accounted in detail in the audio doc. Then my daughter and I go up on the roof, and she sees the same thing I do. And we start recording and filming this object. It's the craziest thing. And through the camera, because I was filming a documentary about my family when this event happened. So by chance, I had a camera on the rooftop that had a pretty good lens. And through the lens, you could see, and you hear my daughter recount as well, that it's actually not an orb. It's three distinct spheres of light, or points of light, and they change in configuration to a triangle, and then there's a section where they're horizontal. This goes on for a long time, and we get my wife. She comes up on the deck and, in my opinion, very hilariously looks through the lens and sees the same thing we see, but she's tired. It's like midnight or it's very late, and she just wants to go to bed. So she looks through the lens and reports seeing the same configuration of lights that my daughter and I are watching, but she just goes back to bed because she prefers sleep over these strange experiences. So that was kind of the next chapter in this, and what was happening for me emotionally watching this display in the sky was that I just felt this uncanny sense that that event was also tied to the initial encounter with that mantis entity. And, you know, to be honest with you, even up to this point and further, I was still feeling like there was an explanation for that initial mantis encounter that might have been somehow just tied to my own imagination, my own imaginal capacity, or a hallucination from the fever, etc. And as these events continue to build, it just becomes harder and harder to have that explanation fully fit the range of experiences that happen because more people enter the picture. And so after this UFO event, I meet a producer in Hollywood. She buys the script, even though I ardently tried to talk her out of buying the script actually for a while because I had all of these other scripts that I thought were quite makeable and were much more viable projects. And she just felt crazy passionately focused that she had to have this script and this mantis story was the story. And so against all odds, she buys this paranormal film about sex trafficking featuring a mantid force as one of the pillars of the story. So I end up writing the script. And I think, well, this is cool. At least I'll get to write this script. I don't think this film will probably get made, but I'm excited to write it. And then while I'm writing the script, that is when we begin to hire people to come and work on the film. She moves forward. Her name is Siona. She's based out of LA, film producer. And she moves forward quite aggressively and starts hiring line producers and other executive producers and a staff of, you know, fluctuating between 10 and 20 people begins working on the film.
And I'll tell you what, before we get into that part of it, because there's a whole sequence of events that happen that are, it's amazing. You know, through the documentary, I thought one of the most interesting aspects was your own incredulity. You know, you're laughing at this thing, at how crazy and ridiculous it must seem. You're kind of enjoying it, but you can tell you're questioning it in your own head. Is this real or not?
Completely. I find one of the most fascinating elements of all of this is my own inability to accept my own experiences because they have grown so strange and so crazy that if it weren't for the fact that other people had experienced many of the things that we'll relate as our conversation unfolds, I wouldn't be talking to you. If it weren't for the fact that these were verified and shared experiences, I wouldn't be able to have this conversation. I was so reluctant to admit what was unfolding over the last 2 years that I have spent at least half of my time trying to metabolize and calm myself down into admitting that these experiences are the ones that I'm having. And I don't interpret them. I'm not here to make a pronouncement about what mantis entities want for planet Earth or something. That's not what this is about. It's really been my incredulity of, you know, I was friends with John Mack. I've known lots of abductees. I've mingled in this world for many years. My worldview is that these strange phenomena do exist, and I believe people's experiences generally, if they're reasonable people and they have accounts that are sensible, I'm willing to believe people's experiences. But I could not believe my own. I really have had a hard time saying publicly what has happened. And tonight really, I guess, marks the event horizon of trying to cross over that and just, you know, actually I would say the audio doc was the first time where I was willing to like, okay, I'm just going to recount what happened, tell it like it is. People can interpret it however they want.
Well, as you've learned, a lot of other people, including creative people, have had encounters with mantis-type creatures or related phenomena. We're talking with Stuart Davis about Man Meets Mantis. We're talking with Stuart Davis, who is an artist with eclectic interests, a filmmaker and recording artist, has his fingers in a lot of creative pies. And as we know from listening to previous programs on Coast to Coast, a lot of creative people have anomalous encounters with beings and UFOs and ghosts and things of that sort. At some point tonight, I want to ask a question of Stuart in our conversation, sort of a chicken and egg question, whether these encounters are a source of the creativity that they experience in their lives, or whether they see these things because they're already creative. We'll get to that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Stuart Davis. Stuart, I'll ask you the question here before we pick up your story and the narrative. You've had time to think about this now. Are you seeing these things because you're already creative, or are you creative because you've seen these things?
It's a great question. And I love the tension point between, you know, what I feel about that coupling actually is that they're both true. I think that my creative constitution and the kind of person that I came into the world as probably predisposes me, probably makes me more prone or inclined, I would say, both towards things like altered states, maybe even hallucinations. But I think also equally legitimately, there does seem to be bumping up against the membrane of these entities that have an ontological status of their own. You know, when this started in 2010, initially I think I would have felt more toward accounting for the experience or these entities as somehow sourced within my creativity. And the longer that it's gone on and the deeper that it's gotten, I do feel squarely planted now in the place of they do have some, they're independent, they exist outside of me, they're there whether or not I am around. And I think the relationship is entirely, in my case, around creativity. It definitely is. That's why at least this one that I've interacted with is attracted to me. And I think my attraction to the experiences is rooted in the fact that I get, you know, I get a supernova of creative explosion and resources. You know, that so much art has come from this range of experiences that as an artist, that's kind of an undeniable seduction. So I think it's both ways, but I think that also probably what creativity is for them, in as much as I'm able to discern something about them, you know, I think that they have a much longer arc and probably a far more grand variety of creativity, and I'm kind of a node. Maybe I'm one node in hundreds or thousands of nodes that, you know, they use as creative touch points.
So they're not here to spark your creativity necessarily. Maybe it's a byproduct of something else that they're up to.
Yeah, I feel like at least the one that I've interacted with, that is a sympathetic resonance. You know, it is creative, and I feel like maybe Mantis entities are not a homogenous unity, and they have some range of distinction, and this one in particular is along the creative spectrum, the artistic spectrum, and it likes the nexus of creative artwork that comes from the relationship, you know, so it's sort of like it likes to put its toe, so to speak, in that pool from time to time, I think.
That first encounter that you had, it was too quick for you to be really frightened. You were kind of excited, as you've told the story, excited about it and wanted to share it with people. Later, though, you had some experiences where you were scared.
Oh, it's so true. And I think that's a very interesting point, because it took me by surprise so much when that first thing happened that, yeah, there was no time to be frightened. And then later on, when very simple things started to happen that should not have been frightening, I did feel crazy fear, paralyzing fear on many occasions. And so to pick it up with one of the more innocent ends of that spectrum, the next remarkable thing that stood out for me that happened was I'd never seen a praying mantis insect in my entire life. I'd never seen one in the wild. And I was at the dog park again with my dog. I spend a lot of time with my dog, and I'm on the phone talking to one of the people working on the film, and I'm kind of complaining into the phone saying, is this ever going to get made? Why is this taking so long? It's been so slow. You know, our movie Mantis is like, maybe it's an unmakeable thing. And as I'm saying those words, a praying mantis insect flies up and lands on my left foot. And it's the first one I've ever seen in the wild. And I, again, just felt eerily sure that that was not a coincidence, not merely a coincidence. I leaned down, I filmed it, I took a bunch of pictures of it. That little insect was looking up at me And my experience was there was intelligence behind those eyes. It just was, it shocked me. I was very shocked, but I was excited. Again, it was like a mix. And so that event began a series of physical visitations. Every time someone would come to work on the film, it would be our cinematographer, it could be the wardrobe person, it was executive producers, they would physically be visited by a praying mantis. And I have taken careful accounting of this. Almost all of them had never seen one before in their lives. You can hear this in the doc. You can hear it in their voices. You can hear them recounting what it was for them to come and start working on this film. Some of them had their own paranormal experiences as they started to write, to read the script and to work on it. But virtually all of the important people working on the film were physically visited by a praying mantis insect the day after or the day of their beginning to work on the film. It's just impossible. That, again, yeah, that's why I made the doc, because if I tried to recount personally a dozen people's experiences being visited by these insects as they came on to work a movie called Mantis, it sounds ridiculous. It's implausible. I myself still feel incredulous. And the reason that document, the audio doc, exists is so that I could bring myself some measure of comfort and sanity, knowing that this did actually happen. You know, one of them even was a white praying mantis. I didn't even know white praying mantises existed. So we began with mine, and then there was a series of a dozen of them.
Well, let's do a couple of them. Share a couple of them with us.
Yeah, one that really means a lot to me was the person who was hired first on the film after me as the writer and director was the line producer, and his name is Joel Sadelik. And when Joel was hired by the producer, Siona, to work on the film, he had terminal cancer. He didn't tell anybody. He just began working on our film. And Mantis was the last movie that Joel ever worked on. And he had a career that spanned decades. I mean, he worked on many films you would know, dozens and dozens of films. And so Mantis was the last film that he ever worked on. And he didn't tell us he was sick. And so while working with him, some of my conversations with him were very unique and emotionally charged. And I understand now in retrospect, it was because he knew he was going to die. And so he would say things to me, you know, don't compromise this script. Whatever you do, do not compromise this script. It's really important this film is made the way it's written. Don't just go for money. Don't start doing that. And I thought that's a very strange thing to hear from a line producer. You know, line producers, they're kind of the accountants of a film. They're in charge of the budget. They're in charge of practical things. You don't normally hear them telling you to be uncompromising about the artistic vision of the film. So I noted that and thought, that's very interesting. And then Joel passed away. And when he passed away and his services were held, his family flew in to go to attend to his service. And they were all gathered together at the airport. And they climbed into one vehicle. And as they climbed into that vehicle, a huge six-inch praying mantis insect flew up, landed on the rearview mirror where his wife was seated. And immediately when that mantis landed on the rearview mirror, the wife's sister, who was also in attendance when Joel passed, shouted, "That's Joel." And that mantis insect stuck to the rearview mirror when they pulled out onto the highway to drive to the gravesite. They were driving 80 miles an hour. It stuck to that mirror for, she said, a good 5 minutes or more. Then fast forward, same person. Joel Sadelik has a memorial service about a year later. And they're at this memorial service, and they're speaking about Joel. And they have this, his wife has this rock with Joel's name on it. And it's sort of part of the memorial service. And she's about to speak her memorial. And a baby praying mantis insect flies up and lands on that rock. And again, the same woman who's with us says, "That's Joel. That's Joel. He's probably going to crawl up your dress. He's so excited to see you." The mantis jumps off the rock, climbs down, flies onto her leg, and does, in fact, crawl up her leg under her dress while they're all, you know, it's a group of a dozen people gathered around witnessing all of this. So that's one instance of a dozen where multiple times, powerful emotional events tied to this film, where these insects have shown up for people that have never seen them before. And it's grown to be a super synchronicity of sorts. There's a bunch of them in the dock, and there's so many of them that I couldn't pack them all in. It just gets to be a little bit repetitious, but I've got dozens and dozens of these photos, and my own the culminating experience of the entire dock is my second mantis synchronicity, which I'll save for us to wrap up with, but it was one of the most astonishing experiences of my life. So yeah, these insects began to populate our experience in that nature, and that it dovetailed into the next category, where I started to have nocturnal experiences, anomalous nocturnal experiences with me and my wife, that pushed me over into the fear territory that you had mentioned earlier.
You were wondering whether you're causing it yourself, your higher self, whether or not you were creating this at some point. So you decided to do some experiments.
Yeah, I still feel that, you know, the nature of consciousness is unknown to me. I don't think that we have a strong enough grasp on consciousness to really fundamentally understand how our individual sentience intersects with the population that's out there in the universe. You know, I think there's probably a whole range of possible relationships. Some of them might be, you know, might be 90% colored from my own imaginal capacity, but I also feel like I'm probably not going to be able to get to the bottom of that ratio. You know, like I mentioned earlier, there's no doubt that my creativity as an artist is playing a major conductive role in this somehow. But I've also gotten to a point where I'm willing to admit these entities have a life of their own. They exist when I'm not around. I exist when they're not around. And this next category of experiences that were happening at night are part of what pushed me in that direction. So I, importantly in this sequence, is that that first film that I sold, Mantis, turned into a trilogy. And then I was hired to write three of these films, which comprised the Mantis trilogy. And while I began that writing process, these nocturnal events started happening where, to begin with, I would wake up. The first one was on January 19th of 2018, so this is still this year. And I had woke up at 3:33, as corny as that sounds. That is literally the time that was on my phone when I woke up and looked at it. It's 3:33 in the morning, and there are coyotes going crazy. I live in Boulder, Colorado. It's not like I'm out in the boonies somewhere, but there are coyotes that kind of roam the perimeter of our neighborhood area. So there's a pack of coyotes just going crazy. My wife and I both wake up. It's really loud, and then they just suddenly stop on a dime, and there's silence, dead silence. And then over my house, which is a vertical house, it's four stories high, and it's kind of narrow and tall with a deck on the top. But over my house, I hear a tuning fork, which as a musician and a music producer, I'm intimately acquainted with that sound. It's very special to me. And there's a tuning fork sound hovering above the top of my house, and it is in reverse. And that turns out to be an important detail because I, as a music producer, one of my favorite things to do in the studio is to reverse parts. And I do this so much that it's kind of a running joke with the artists that I work with. It is, it's like a trademark move of mine. So to hear a tuning fork hovering over my house and repeating in reverse with also another very special characteristic, which is the percussion point you would usually hear where you would hit a tuning fork has been like trimmed off. So you're only hearing it in reverse without the percussion point. And that is quintessentially something I would do. And so I sit up in my bed and I stand up and I start walking around my house, sticking my head out of windows, again, incredulous, trying to figure out why on earth there is something hovering over my house, although I can't see anything. Nothing's visible. There's no other component to the phenomenon other than this auditory. And this goes on for 15 minutes. I stand at an open door, sticking my head out of the house, and I begin to feel great fear. And the fear that I probably should have felt when the mantis initially visited me and wasn't there, now I do feel it. And I feel like something intelligent is communicating to me specifically in a language with a signifier, this auditory signifier that is so personal that it scares me very badly. I try to get my dog to come up off the bed. I have a 100-pound Doberman Pinscher protection dog. It will not move. And eventually I give up and I put earplugs into my ears and I go back to bed and just want it to end. And the coyotes, as a perfect bookend, like the coyotes went crazy and then went silent. Then I have this tuning fork over my house. Then it's when I put the tuning or when I put the earplugs back in, the coyotes go crazy again. And that is the end of the experience. So like strangely, these animals are forming bookends on this auditory anomaly over my house.
The dog wouldn't go out. That's a tough
one. It's unbelievable. My dog it's a protection dog. It will go crazy. It does go crazy. Anything walks around our house or nearby, it lunges at the windows. That's the whole reason we have this dog. It's like, well, one of them, one of the main reasons. So for it to be unwilling to just step outside onto the deck with me was very strange. However, this happens again for me. It's 10 days later, January 29th, 2018. And again, it's super corny. I think it's corny. I laughed even when I see these, but I wake up at 3:13 in the morning and the same sequence happens. There's the crazy coyotes. There's the tuning fork in reverse. It's hovering over my house. I'm standing up. I'm walking around the house. I'm trying to get my dog to go out on the deck with me. He will not do it. And I basically repeat exactly the same experience 10 days later. And in my emotional experience of all this going down, I know that it's tied again to the mantis visit, to the insect appearances that are happening for everyone in the film. I know I'm being signaled personally, like this message, whatever it is, because there's no content other than a sound, but it's personal.
I'll take a break. We're talking with Stuart Davis about Man Meets Mantis, and there is another chapter still to come in this. Where you get some clarification from a shamanic person who knows what she's doing. It's a great story and much more to come here on Coast to Coast with Stuart Davis. And the Shantays take us into the break with Pipeline.